Welcome to Dolly Reads for You with Dolly Howard, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you are alive.
Thank you. Nancy had to shut me up so we could do my show. I'm still laughing about it.
I'm good at shutting people up. I just push the mute button.
That's a good idea, yeah. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is Wednesday, April 3rd already, 2019. You're listening to Durfee. Dolly reads for you. And I'm kind of out of breath right now, but I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good, so just ignore my breathing. I've been doing my laundry that I haven't done for a month. I just haven't had the energy, but lately, all of a sudden, I'm getting more energies again. Of course, I had a talk with Mr. Turtle, and I had a talk with my Mr. Silver that I have around my neck, my silver saturated shungite. And we reprogrammed, and then I had to go talk to Mr. Spiral, and so he and I and the other two shungites all got together on the same page, and I'm feeling better. Had to do a little retuning. So, there was something I was going to share with you all besides that nonsense. I don't know what it was. If I think of it, you know I'll stop in the middle and tell you. Let me get the light on. It's getting dark in here. We're reading Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Otherworldly Beings by Brad Steiger and Sherry Hansen Steiger. Let me see if I can find where we left off. I think we read that part. Why did I have that page marked? Oh, boy, I should have looked at this before we got started, but I was all excited about something else that Nancy had to shut me up about. No, I guess this is it. Okay. I can get on a roll, you know. Okay, we're going to read, what's the name of this chapter? It's an interesting chapter. I've been enjoying it. Of course, I've been enjoying the whole book. Oh, name of the chapter, The We People, Guardians of the Earth Mother. The section we're at now is We Folk in Native American Traditions. The authors have spent a great deal of time studying tribunal legends and folklore with many Native American medicine priests. So we were not at all surprised to discover that there doesn't appear to be a single tribe that does not acknowledge the existence of the We People. And the generic Native American name for fairies, Pukwudjuni, I never heard that one before, is so similar to the ones used to identify the We People in other parts of the world that one might actually entertain the thesis that such uniformity may suggest that the fairies themselves have given the name as their own personal identification. Pukwudjuni, Pukwudjini, is an Algonquin word commonly used among many Native American tribes, which signifies little vanishing people. Pukwudjuni, the name brings immediately to mind Shakespeare's Sweet Puck, who in A Midsummer Night's Dream chuckles about how foolish mortals be. From Puck in England, we cross the waters to find Puke, P-U-K-E, a generic name for minor spirits in all the Teutonic and Scandinavian dialects. Puke is, I hate saying puke, am I pronouncing that right? Well, anyway, that's how I'm going to say it. That's how it's spelled. Puke is cognate with the German spuck. Bye, Mona. German spuck or spook, S-P-U-K, a goblin. And the Dutch spook, a frightening ghost. There is also, of course, the Irish pooka of Elwood P. Dowd and Harvey fame, as well as the Cornish pixie. Separate the suffix of puck, wood, ginny, and we are left with ginny, the Arab's magical denizen of wondrous lamps and other domiciles. Oh my gosh, I swear they go out and look for words that I can't pronounce or figure out. Okay, I'm going to have some patience here. Twyla Nitch, a great Native American medicine teacher of the Seneca tribe, told us that one day as she was sitting at the edge of a river, she glanced up to see a little vanishing person coming toward her. When their eyes made contact, the little person scowled and asked, "Can you see me?" And then he answered his own question, "You can see me." "Of course I can see you," she said, laughing. "I'm a medicine teacher, a shaman, one who strives always to be at one with nature. I can always see you and your kind." The wee person was persistent. "But only when we allow you to do so. I wasn't allowing you to see me, so you shouldn't have been able to." The medicine teacher shrugged. "Don't worry. I won't tell the people over there at the picnic table that you are here. But you better quickly be about your business, because I know those children at the swings have already spotted you." That reminds me, Nancy, I wanted to tell you and Walt last night that that man that was in my bathroom, that being that couldn't cross the threshold, is gone. He was gone the night we were discussing it, because I had asked Dave about him, and Dave said, "Don't worry about him," and then the guy never showed up again.
Good for Dave.
Yeah.
Good for you for asking.
Yeah, really. I never even thought about it. Because I'm so surrounded with angels, I just figure they'll take care of everything. But I hadn't even asked them, "What about this guy?" So I'm glad you all brought that up. He's gone, and it does feel better in here. Okay, back to the book. New section. Respect the lands sacred to wee folk. Respect the lands sacred to wee folk. I was reading that wrong in my head. Careless or disrespectful humans who trespass on forest glens, rivers, or lakes, considered sacred to elves, may suffer terrible consequences. Entrepreneurs who wish to desecrate land whereon lie fairy circles or mounds in order to build a road or construct a commercial building may find themselves combating an unseen enemy who will accept only their unconditional surrender, or at least an acceptable compromise. Oh, wow, that was a short thing. Just a paragraph. New section titled Consequences. Consequences of Disrespecting the Rules of the Hidden Folk. In 1962, the new owners of a herring processing plant in Iceland decided to enlarge the work area of the building. According to Icelandic tradition, landowners must not fail to reserve a small area of their property for the hidden folk. Well, isn't that special? I like that tradition. And a number of the established residents earnestly pointed out to the recent arrivals that any addition to the processing plant would encroach upon the plant, upon the plot of ground that the original owners had respectfully set aside for the elves who lived under the ground. In a condescending manner, the businessmen explained that they didn't harbor those old superstitions, and neither did their highly qualified construction crew, who had modern, unbreakable drill bits and plenty of explosives. But the bits of the unbreakable drills began to shatter one after another. An old farmer came forward to repeat the warning that the crew was trespassing on land that belonged to the hidden folk. The workmen laughed when the old man walked away, but the drill bits kept breaking. Finally, the manager of the plant, although professing disbelief in such nonsense, agreed to the local resident's recommendation that he consult a local elf seer to establish contact with the hidden folk and attempt to make peace with them. The seer informed the manager that there was a very powerful member of the hidden folk who had selected the spot near the herring processing plant as his personal dwelling place. He was not an unreasonable being, however. Elves really do try to get along with humans and compromise whenever they can to avoid violence. In the processing plant, really, if the processing plant really needed the plot for its expansion, the elf seer said, the hidden one would agree to find another place to live. He asked only for 5 days without any drilling so that he could make his arrangements to move. The manager felt a bit strange bargaining with a being that was invisible, as far as he was concerned, imaginary, but he looked over the pile of broken drill bits and told the seer that the hidden one had a deal. Work on the site was shut down for 5 days to give the elf a chance to move. When the 5 days had passed and the workmen resumed drilling, the work went smoothly and efficiently until the addition to the plant was completed. There were no more shattered bits on the unbreakable drill. Because the incident cited above occurred in 1962, practically back in medieval times in some young people's minds, really? 1962, for goodness sake. Many readers will no doubt assume that Icelanders of the 21st century no longer cherish such quaint beliefs. Those readers would be wrong. 1962, a long time ago. I was in high school then. New section called Mischief Befalls Those Who Did Not Recognize the Elves' Domain. In the Boston Herald, December 25, 2005, Rick Bury wrote that highway engineers and construction crews still regard the hidden folk very seriously. Mischief befalls Icelandic road builders who can't recognize good elf domain, including breakdowns of heavy equipment and even worker mishaps and injuries. It is said to have happened on more than one job site, enough to take the mythology seriously. Consequently, road planners here consult with an elf expert before routing a road or highway through rock piles that may be elf habitat. Bury interviewed elf seer Erla Stefansdottir, who named elves, gnomes, dwarves, angels, light fairies, and the hidden people as all belonging to classes of what she called elfin beings. Any of the above-named entities, Miss Stefansdottir said, can get quite upset if we ruin their houses or go against their wishes. They get very upset and we have to face the consequences. They can put a spell on us. While some people may be surprised that the stereotypical stoic Scandinavians believe in elves and other beings from the hidden world, it seems that the whole world embraces the stereotype of the country folk of Ireland, taking their wee people seriously. According to popular leprechaun and elf stories, the Irish know that to disturb the mounds or rats in which they dwell is to invite severe supernatural consequences. Since ancient times, it seems that the Irish have understood that there are certain areas that the wee ones consider sacrosanct or special to them. Certain mounds, caves, creek areas, and forest clearings have been staked out by the hidden ones as their very own. And the wise human, sensitively in touch with the natural environment, knows better than to trespass on such ground. Hi, Aquarius. Welcome. New section. Trouble at the Fairy Mound at Wexford. Let me breathe a few minutes. The trouble at the Fairy Mound outside the village of Wexford began when workmen from the State Electricity Board began digging a hole for the erection of a light pole within the perimeters of the Rath, and that's spelled R-A-T-H. It's not W-R-A-T-H, where you get mad, Rath. This is their place where they like. The villagers warned the workmen that the my teeth keep falling down. I apologize. The workmen, let me see. Hold on. The villagers warned the workmen that the pole, come on, that the pole, see, I can't say it, my teeth fall down. My gums have shrunk so much, my teeth don't fit me anymore. Let me try this again. The villagers warned the workmen that the pole would never stay put, because no self-respecting community of fairy folk could abide a disturbance on their mound. The big city electrical workmen had a coarse laugh and made uncomplimentary remarks about the level of intelligence of the townsfolk of Wexford. The workmen finished digging the hole to the depth that experience had taught them was adequate. Then they placed the post within the freshly dug opening and stamped the black earth firmly around its base. The satisfied foreman pronounced for all within earshot that no fairy would move the pole from where it had been anchored. However, the next morning, the pole tilted askew in loose earth. The villagers shrugged that the wee folk had done it. But the foreman of the crew voiced his suspicions that the fairies had received some help from some humans bent on mischief. Glaring his resentment at any villagers who would meet his narrowed, accusative eyes, the foreman ordered his men to reset the pole. The next morning, that one particular pole was once again conspicuous in the long line of newly placed electrical posts by its weird tilt in the loose soil at its base. While the other poles in the line stood straight and proud, like soldiers on parade inspection, that one woebegone post reeled like a trooper who had had one pint too many. The foreman had endured enough of such rural humor at his expense. He ordered the crew to dig a hole 6 feet wide, place the pole precisely in the middle, and pack the earth so firmly around the base that nothing short of an atomic bomb could budge it. Apparently, fairies have their own brand of nuclear fission. For the next morning, the intrusive pole had once again been pushed loose of the little people's wrath. The foreman and his crew from the electricity board finally knew when they were licked. Without another word to the grinning villagers, the workmen dug a second hole 4 feet outside of the fairy mound and dropped the pole in there. And that was where it stood, untouched and untroubled, exactly where the wee folk permitted it to stand. Good for them. New section. The rock in St. Fillan's belonged to the wee folk. I am really having some troubles here. I'm going to try something. Nancy, if you have trouble understanding me, please let me know, and I will put my teeth back in. They won't stay up for nothing today. Okay, in the Times, November 21, 2005, Will Pavai and Chris Wendell tell how a small colony of wee folk living beneath a rock in St. Fillan's, Perthshire, cost developer Marcus Salter, head of the Genesis Properties, nearly $40,000 when community pressure forced him to scrap his building plans and start again. Silly people. When they don't believe in these things, they deserve what they get. A group of his workmen had been about to move a large rock from the center of a field to make way for the new housing development. According to Salter, one of the residents of St. Fillan's came running, shouting that they couldn't move the rock or they would kill the fairies. At first, Salter thought the man was joking. Then came the sirens of angry telephone calls, the series of angry telephone calls. Salter attended a meeting of the community council where he learned that the council was considering lodging a complaint with the planning authority, which was likely to be the kiss of death for a housing development in a national park. Although the planning inspectorate has no specific guidelines on how to deal with fairies, a spokesman told Salter that planning guidance states that local customs and beliefs must be taken into account when a developer applies for planning permission. Salter was forced to redesign the new estate so that the Wee People's Rock would be in the center of a small park nicely situated within the new community. Oh, that's cute. I hope they liked it, the little people, the Wee People. New section called An American in Ireland learns never to cross the Wee People. When we were discussing some recent accounts of Wee People activity receiving media attention, author, researcher, and journalist Patricia Ress, R-E-S-S, recalled her stay with an Irish family when she visited Ireland some years ago. They owned a large hotel that dated back to before the Easter Uprising in 1916 and had housed lots of IRA, that's Irish Republican Army, activity, Patty said. The owner of this place, Mr. Conroy, told me that there are fairy rings all around the area outside of Dublin. Especially in St. Kevin's Bed, there is a story of a truck driver who made fun of the villagers for their superstition about the fairy circles. And to prove how stupid he felt they were, he drove his truck through one of them. Oh my gosh. Then he got out of the truck, laughed at the crowd watching him, and promptly died of a heart attack. Conroy swore that this man was a big fellow in perfect health. Serves him right. How many of the Wee People did he kill or hurt? Had to get a drink.
Did you want to take a break?
Oh, is it time? Yes. Thank you. Is it okay with my teeth out?
Oh, and until you just mentioned it, I'd forgotten it, so I guess so.
Oh, cool. Oh, thank you.
I mean, if my teeth are out, yours might as well be out, too.
Well, let me finish just one thing. It's only two more paragraphs.
Oh, okay. I thought it was finished.
Oh. No. So, the guy dropped over dead from a heart attack. Patty heard another story while she was in Ireland about some construction workers who wanted to remove a stump near a fairy ring. They felt that since it wasn't actually in the fairy ring, the coast was clear. They tried to dynamite the stump 3 or 4 times and nothing happened. They checked the dynamite, the wiring, and so forth. And nothing. Finally, they all saw a little man dressed in green climb out of the stump and run. Just as he ran off, the stump exploded into a million pieces. As crazy as this sounds, there was a photographer there from the local newspaper who had heard about all the problems and was going to take a picture of them trying to blow up the stump. He did actually get a picture of the leprechaun. However, Patty was told, the photograph is locked away somewhere in Trinity College. Patty recalled many conversations with the maid at the hotel where she stayed, and the maid said that she had heard many stories of people who had seen the wee folks. And on one thing, all the stories agreed, Patty said, you never want to cross one. Not ever. That's the end of that section.
Okay, then you want a 4-minute break?
Yes, please.
We're going to be doing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are live.
Okay. I was looking at those fairy pictures. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah, they came in a lot more versions than I thought.
Well, yeah. I was really impressed.
What we did was we Googled the images of fairy circles. That's what I put it up in the chat. That was what she was looking at.
They're pretty cool. Okay, now, new section. We are part of a larger community of intelligences. Whew. Hold on, my eyes have to adjust. My head started spinning, therefore my eyes were seeing things in spins. Jeez, come on.
Why was your eyes spinning? I mean, your head spinning.
I don't know. It's just been doing that lately. That's why I can't stand up and walk around much, because that happens and then I start falling.
Oh, boy.
Annette did a good thing for me yesterday. I always have trouble cleaning the litter boxes up because I have to bend over, and when I bend over, I tend to pass out. So I don't want to pass out with my head in the litter boxes, so she says. She put the card table up, put the litter box, one of the litter boxes on the card table. And then she got this TV stand that we have, that under the TV stand that has shelves and stuff. So it's a pretty good sized TV stand. And she put the other litter box on that one. Then we put a chair next to the table. And so now I don't have to bend over to clean the litter box. It was such a good thing today. The girls love it because they get to jump all over the table and the chair, and they're loving it. But I am too.
That's just such a perfect solution.
It is. Yeah. It really is. Oh, the cats are happy. I'm happy.
And Annette's happy. She won't have to pull you out of the cat litter.
Yeah, really. Oh, for goodness sake, yes. Because one time it happened, and thank God the kids weren't home.
I won't tell.
Okay, thank you. Don't anybody tell. Only one time. All the way. Are you still there? I hit a button by mistake.
No, I'm still here. We're good. We're good.
Okay. All right, let's read this last chapter in this last section in this chapter. We are part of a larger community of intelligences. Our many years of research have led us to theorize that there may exist throughout the world pockets of energy in which another order of intelligence abides. And we should make clear that we agree wholeheartedly with Elf Seer Erla Stefansdottir, who includes elves, gnomes, dwarfs, angels, light fairies, ooh, I don't know how to say this, N-I-S-S-E, Nissi, nice, I don't know, brownies, scaramouches, I never heard of that one, and divas, as a single shape-shifting intelligence that we have come to call the hidden people. In some instances, these pockets of intelligent energy may be influenced by human intelligence and manifest in a physical form as a variation on the theme of a human image. In other circumstances, this energy may direct and control, even possess, human beings. I don't think I like that possession stuff. In essence, these nature spirits may be the elder race or the old ones referred to in so many myths and legends. These vortexes of intelligence may constitute a companion species to our own and may well have maintained a strange kind of symbolic relationship with us throughout the centuries of mutual evolution. American David Spangler of Findhorn Foundation community in Scotland claimed that he was told by such an intelligence that these entities recognize humankind as a necessary and vital part of the synergistic state of the planet. Thus, these entities are essentially benignly concerned with human survival because it bears directly upon the survival of Earth. Spangler's understanding of humankind's relationship to these entities is that we were first cousins and that we somehow had a common ancestor. We perceive the other, whether of terrestrial or extraterrestrial origin, as communicating with us essentially through the subconscious mind. That is why experiences with these entities seem to happen more often and most effectively when the percipient is in an altered state of consciousness. And that is why UFO experiences, fairyland adventures, angelic visitations, and so forth sound so much like dreams. They are really occurring when the percipient is in a dreamlike state. The conscious mind of the percipient remembers certain highlights of the experience or interprets the symbols and lessons in a consciously acceptable manner. But the actual teaching mechanism and the important information have been indelibly etched upon the experiencer's subconscious. What such seemingly disparate phenomena as the appearance of we people and the visitations of angels throughout the world means to us is that we humans are part of a larger community of intelligences, a much more complex hierarchy of powers and principalities, a potentially richer kingdom of interrelated species, both physical and non-physical, than most people are bold enough to believe in. As we have previously declared, once we have correctly fathomed the meaning of the other and its total relevance to our lives, we will perceive an evolved intelligence whose manifestations we have been mistakenly labeling as our gods, our angels, or our demons, and who have been challenging us, teaching us, and preparing us to recognize our true place in the cosmic scheme of things. It's the end of that chapter. New chapters titled Meeting Strange Creatures in Dark Forests. Humankind has been aware of strange creatures, both seen and unseen, and physical and non-physical, since at least the Paleolithic Age, when primitive artists painted images of supernatural beings on the walls of their caves. Hold on. Yes, CG, Mommy loves you. Yes, I love you. Lay down. Lay down. It's a good girl. She just jumped up on the bed. She hadn't seen me in 10 minutes. You'd think it was forever. Okay, as early as the 3rd millennium BCE, the written records of ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia recognized a hierarchy of supernatural beings that ruled over various parts of the earth, the universe, and the lives of human beings. These ancient people also believed in lower levels of entities that might be either hostile or benign in their actions toward them. Every known creature on earth has its accounts of benevolent and malevolent beings who manifest from an unseen world. And in recent years, there has been a tremendous surge of interest in ghosts, demons, and creatures of darkness, as well as guardian angels and guiding spirits who transcend everyday existence. A vicious attack on a young couple by a damned thing. Ooh, that sounds ominous. Wait a minute, I have just my book here. It's falling down. There we go. Together with the return of her questionnaire, Lori Jastrow sent us an account of an experience that happened to her and her fiancé Carl shortly before their marriage. They had gone to a movie, then decided to drive out to the tiny house in the country where they would live after they had celebrated their nuptials. Lori thought it was fun to go out there and plan their future. The house was on land that was too heavily wooded to be good farmland, but they didn't intend to farm the acreage, only to plant a small garden for vegetables. Carl would continue his job in town. Oh, jeez, I turned a page to this frickin' scary face. Monster-type face. Only our light that night were our flashlights, Lori wrote in her account. Since we wouldn't be moving in for another month or so, the landlord had yet to switch on the electricity. He had given us keys to the place, though, and he didn't mind that we would drive out there to dream about our future life together. That night when they walked into the house, Lori had an eerie feeling that something was wrong, that they were not alone. Carl must have felt the same way as I did, she said, because he kept looking over his shoulder, like he expected to catch sight of someone spying on us. Then we heard a strange chattering, like some giant squirrel or chipmunk, coming from a dark corner in the room. Oh, man, in the room, Lori continued. It suddenly seemed so unreal, unearthly, and a strange coldness passed over my body. I told Carl that I wanted to leave, that I was frightened. But before they could move toward the door, Carl suddenly threw his hands up over his head as if he were trying to grab at something behind him. His head seemed pulled back into one side. His mouth froze in a grimace of pain and fear, and his eyes rolled wildly. He lost his balance, fell to his knees, then to his side. He rolled madly on the floor, fighting and clawing the air around his neck. Lori stood stunned with fear and bewilderment. Carl managed to struggle to his feet. His eyes bulged, and he gasped fiercely for each breath. Some unseen thing seemed to be strangling him. He gasped that they must run to the car, that Lori must drive. Somehow they got out of the house with Carl stumbling, staggering as if something heavy and strong were perched atop his shoulders with a death grip about his throat. "I can't get the damned thing off me," he gasped. At last they got to the car. Lori got behind the wheel and Carl told her to drive fast. He was still trying to pry the invisible thing's hands from his throat. Lori drove for about 2 miles down the road, and suddenly there was a blinding flash inside the car. A brilliant ball of light, about the size of a basketball, shot ahead of their car, then veered sharply to the left and disappeared into a clump of trees. "I did not stop until we were back in town," Lori said. Carl lay gasping beside me, his head rolling limply on the back of the seat. He did not speak until we were well inside the city limits. Then he said that some inhuman thing had jumped on him from the shadows of the house. He was certain that it could have killed him if it had really wanted to do so. Lori Jastrow concluded her account by writing that although they returned to their small home in the country with some trepidation, they never again encountered that monstrous invisible strangler that chattered like a giant rodent. Once the nature spirit had time to calm down and come to terms with the fact that humans were reclaiming the empty house, it moved on to another more appropriate dwelling, but it certainly did give Carl and Lori a piece of its mind before it did so. I never would have gone back to that house. Gotta give them kudos for having the guts to do that. Oh boy, I wouldn't have. I would have been afraid it would have killed him the next time. Okay, new section called The Unintended Consequences of Leaving a Vacation Home Unoccupied. People who leave their vacation homes empty for the major portion of the year also frequently suffer from a nature spirit or some woodland being developing a proprietary interest in what appears to be vacant property free for the taking. Scott Halstead said that he and his family had vacationed in the same cabin in the Northeast for the past 22 years. We started vacationing in this cabin when Alan was 2 years old, and we always take the last 2 weeks in August. He stated in his account, and for 22 years, we've had to share the cabin with something else. Scott and his wife Lynette made a point to emphasize their contention that although the something else sometimes frightened them, their sense of the entity was that it was extremely protective of the cabin and the grounds on which their cabin and others like it had been built. The cabin and 9 or 10 others are situated on a beautiful lake, Halstead said, and Old Charlie, the caretaker, knows that there is something kind of spooky going on around there. But he usually just shrugs and says that it doesn't bother him. It sometimes bothers his dogs, though. He's got 2 big German shepherds, and I've seen them cower and whine when neither Charlie nor anyone else was near them. Lynette said that when their son Alan was about 4 years old, he would say that he had an invisible friend named Moco, who lived in the woods. If we were afraid that he might wander off in the woods, he would say, "Moco won't let me. He says that I have to stay near the cabins." Who could complain if this invisible playmate was also a good babysitter? Lynette and Scott agreed that the most dramatic evidence of a guardian spirit looking over the cabin came in 1985, when Alan was 11 and their daughter Tanya was 7. Scott and I had gone swimming, Lynette said. The kids knew that we would be chilled when we got out of the lake, and a fire would feel good to us. Alan had watched his father building a fire for years, so he knew the basics, but he just kept piling on kindling. Uh-oh. Tanya tossed newspapers and magazines onto the fire, and pretty soon they had a huge blaze roaring in that fireplace. Shivering, clutching towels to their chilled bodies, Scott and Lynette returned to the cabin to see the colonial-style rag rugs in front of the fireplace on fire, the curtains to the side of the chimney ablaze, and another finger of flame moving across scattered newspapers toward the living room carpet. There was a moment of panic when you just kind of scream and shout before your brain kicks in, Lynette said. Alan and Tanya were standing against a wall, crying their heads off in fear. And then, as weird as it may seem, as strange as it is for Scott and Lynette to attest to, something started to beat out the flames. I'm standing there barefooted and soaked in my swimming suit, with a towel wrapped around me, Scott said. I don't even have time to react, really, when I see something snuffing out the fire. More than beating out the flames, it's like something is smothering it as if it's covering the fire with a big wet blanket. In minutes, what looked like it would be a major disaster has become a smoke-filled cabin, a couple of burned and scorched throw rugs, a blitzed curtain, and two crying kids. Lynette said that she hugged Alan and Tanya and gave thanks to God and to whatever protective spirit looks out for the cabins. Over the years, Lynette and Scott said that there were numerous signs to indicate that some spirit entity was protective of the cabin. All of the family said that from time to time, they felt someone was watching them. Items would disappear and reappear in bizarre places, and an eerie kind of scratching noise would often be heard issuing from within the walls. Out of curiosity, they once wrote to the Wagners, a family they knew rented the cabin in July, and asked if they ever noticed anything peculiar during their occupancy. Beverly Wagner wrote right back and said, "I imagine you're referring to the invisible live-in maid." Live-in maid. Lynette laughed at the memory. The Wageners had noticed some of the same numerous little things that we had, but once when they left a messy table after a party at the cabin, they woke up the next morning to discover that someone or something had stacked the dirty dishes in the sink and cleaned the table up. Too bad Nat and I don't have something like that around here. Jim Wagner jokingly said that it must be elves, so he left a bowl of oatmeal on the front step that night. In the next morning, it was gone. But of course, birds or some critter could have eaten it. Scott and Lynette speculated that it could be the spirit of some Native American who cherished the environment around the lake and who kept a vigil over the cabins and their inhabitants. But they added that they had come to believe that the force, the energy, that loved the place so much was something more primeval. It's almost as if nature itself is somehow protective of the few remaining areas that we humans haven't covered over with concrete and erected shopping malls and gas stations, Scott said. Sometimes I would visualize some kind of elf or nature spirit sitting outside near the lake, looking across the beauty of this area toward the city and sighing, "What fools these mortals be." Okay, before I start this next little section, do you want to do a break?
Yeah, we'll do your favorite one here. Well, you know, your recent favorite one.
Thank you.
And you're alive.
And I have to come back to reality. Thank you for playing that song. I love it.
You're quite welcome. I love it too.
Oh, man. I can relax now. Oh, the next one is titled The Man-Like Thing at the Side of the Road. And there's a scary picture again. Josephine wrote to us to report a real encounter with a man-like thing that occurred at approximately 1:30 a.m. on June 21st, 2011. Excuse me. My niece experienced a frightful event, which has her rethinking about her lifestyle and changing it, Josephine said. She was driving on the highway when she came upon what she thought was a man walking on the road. As she got closer, the creature spread its wings and flew up, and she almost hit the thing. When she looked in the rearview mirror, she saw that there was a vehicle behind her. She saw the vehicle swerve, as if it had almost hit the creature, too. My niece was terrified and didn't entertain the thought of whether she should stop and ask the other vehicle behind her to confirm what she had seen. She was traveling with family in different cars that night, and she stopped at the next town at a gas station with good lighting to wait for her mom to catch up. Then she asked for her sister to ride home with her that night. Don't blame her. Josephine's specific question was whether her niece's frightening encounter could possibly be linked to the date being that the beginning of the summer solstice and various activities associated with conjuration of entities. Could such entities be summoned to manifest in physical form, to roam the earth, and to be seen at this time? Or was this a common creature sighting that could appear any time of the year? I do know one thing, she said. This is the first of our family. Then she added, besides the sightings of the lights in the sky that have been seen in our area that the military claims are unexplainable. Then she added, besides the sightings of the lights in the sky that have been seen in our, okay, I do not, This is a fur. Oh, a first. I knew I read something wrong. I do know one thing, she said. This is a first for our family. Then she added, besides the sightings of the lights in the sky that have been seen in our area, that the military claims are unexplainable. Okay, that made better sense. New section called Encounter in a Dark Woods. I thought I started. Oh, that was way back there. Got myself in confused again. Okay. Encounter in a Dark Woods by Noe, N-O-E, Torres. Noe Torres, UFO investigator, is the author of Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash and Fallen Angel. UFO crash near Laredo, Texas. Noe holds a bachelor's degree in English and a master's degree in library science from the University of Texas at Austin, with California UFO researcher Ruben Uriarte, U-R-I-A-R-T-E. He has written three books. Mexico's Roswell, the Chihuahua UFO Crash, the other Roswell UFO Crash on the Texas-Mexico border, and Aliens in the Forest. The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter with Roswell historian John LeMay, Noe wrote The Real Cowboys and Aliens, UFO Encounters of the Old West. He also served as editor and publisher of the books Roswell USA by John LeMay, Roswell Alien Autopsy by Philip Mantle, and Russia's Roswell Incident by Paul Stonehill and Philip Mantle. In the 1940s, my parents owned a small frame home surrounded by 4 acres of orange and grapefruit trees in a very isolated corner of South Texas, about 20 miles from the border with Mexico. The home and surrounding groves of trees were incredibly dark at night, as there were no sources of artificial light, and the nearest town was 10 miles away. I vividly remember, as a child, staring nervously out the window of my bedroom at the dark, shadowy trees at night, and wondering what things might lurk there. I also remember a story my mom told me several times about the night she had a close encounter with an entity amidst the trees surrounding our home. This was not the type of tale that mothers tell their children to keep them from wandering out of the house at night. In fact, I was already around 10 or 12 years old when she first told me about it, and her tone was deathly serious. I believe she told me the story as a means of getting a very distressing incident off her chest. It happened in the dead of night when my dad was out of town on construction work and my mom was home alone with 3 sleeping children. She was awakened by noises and commotion coming from the backyard. The various barnyard animals that my parents kept penned in the backyard, including goats and chickens, were highly agitated. The family dog was barking and whimpering. Into the middle of this commotion stepped my mother, eager to determine what was stirring up the animals. In order to reach the animal pens, she had to walk about 100 feet from the rear door of the house and into the midst of a grove of closely planted citrus trees. She was essentially surrounded on all sides by the trees. As she walked toward the pens, she was joined by the family dog, which still seemed to be frightened and agitated. Oh, bless his heart, he joined her. Suddenly, my mom felt what she described as a presence, and she heard a commotion directly overhead. Simultaneously, the dog began barking very loudly, leaping high into the air, and snapping his jaws at some unseen thing. Mom was unable to lift her head up to see what was above her. She felt a force or will that denied her the ability to lift her head up. A circle of light seemed to suddenly spring up around her, and she continued hearing strange whining or roaring noises from above. A devoted evangelical, my mom immediately assumed an attitude of prayer and began requesting God's help with the situation. Around her, the chaos persisted as her dog continued leaping wildly into the air as if trying to reach something. The situation seemed to reach a stasis, during which time seemed to be frozen. She did not know exactly how long this state persisted. Then, in an instant, the light around her blinked off. The dog became quiet, the penned animals were still, and the presence that she had felt in the sky above her was gone. Somewhat dazed by the experience, she stumbled back to the house and took some time to sit and recover from her ordeal before returning to bed. She told me this story several times and always seemed to be struggling to understand it, to puzzle it out. The incident troubled her deeply and left her feeling confused and unsettled. She thought about it all the rest of her life and tried in vain to make sense of it. Unfortunately, I did not know enough about UFOs at the time to check into whether she might have experienced missing time as a result of the encounter. It's a picture of the house where he lived. He was talking about, it's just a little thing, a little tiny house. New section called, let me breathe first and get a drink. Okay. Dark forest encounters may produce life-altering insights and new teachings for humankind. On a hot fall day in 1979, Brad answered the doorbell in the Steiger home in Scottsdale, Arizona, to find an attractive, well-dressed young Hispanic man on the front porch. The unexpected caller identified himself as a Peruvian gems dealer who was calling on clients in the United States. I can hear myself in the background.
When
you're hearing an echo?
I'm hearing myself.
All right, okay. I'll put the headphones in. You just starting to hear it?
No, I was hearing it all along, but I seemed to get it a little more to my attention when I said something.
All right. Is that better? Talk.
No, I still hear myself. Are you editing something I said?
No. I'm not touching anything. I'm not even sitting near the computer except now.
Yeah. It's not what I'm saying now, though. Yes. No. Yes. Wait. Yep. Isn't that strange? I I'm in. My system? Let me see. Did I turn off the... Uh-oh. Did I turn off the radio? Hold on. No, I still hear it. Well, that is weird. Let me try this. No, I'm listening. Well, because it's not what I'm saying. It's something entirely different. Let me listen a minute. Well, okay, I'm not hearing it now. Oh, who knows? No. That's really strange. I don't know what's going on. Huh. One of those unexplained things happening in my life. All right, I will continue with where was I? Let's start at the beginning of this. Dark forest encounters may produce life-altering insights and new teachings for humankind. On a hot fall day in 1979, Brad answered the doorbell in the Steiger home in Scottsdale, Arizona, to find an attractive, well-dressed young Hispanic man on the front porch. The unexpected caller identified himself as a Peruvian gems dealer who was calling on clients in the United States. When he had stopped for gas at a truck stop outside of Phoenix, he saw a long-haired man dressed in a robe being harassed by a group of young men. He intervened, took the robed fellow into his car, and asked if he could help him in some way. The man, who was dressed like an Old Testament prophet, reached into his robe and handed the salesman a piece of paper with an address on it. The address was that of Brad Steiger's. "Do you know this man?" the Peruvian gentleman asked Brad, a quizzical smile and frown betraying his skepticism. As Brad drew closer to the automobile, the robed, bearded man slid out of the passenger's seat and stepped out onto the hot pavement. He smiled broadly and waved. The jewelry salesman soon had Brad's answer. "Yes," he replied. "He is a good friend of mine, Dr. Wolf Weilgart. He is a genius, a professor of linguistics and psychology. We used to teach at the same Midwestern college." In 1966, after Brad had written his first book on UFOs, Strangers from the Skies, many of his fellow faculty members had great fun making little green men from Mars jokes at Brad's expense. When Dr. Wolfgang John Weilgart was asked his opinion of such matters as space creatures, the questioners no doubt expected the psychotherapist, with doctoral degrees in linguistics and psychology from universities in Vienna and Heidelberg, to diagnose Steiger as a bona fide crackpot. Instead, Dr. Weilgart replied that when he was a child, he had met beings from elsewhere who wished to teach him and guide him in helping others toward the ways of peace and understanding. What was more, in a single mystic moment, he was given a UI, see page 149, a new language for a new brother of man. See page 149, a UI. Oh, I guess we'll get to that in a couple pages. Okay, where was I? The two men had become friends. And in 1967, Dr. Weilgart had written the afterword to Brad's book, The Mass Murderer, a study of serial killers. After Brad had left the faculty and obtained an office in the city, Dr. Weilgart would come often to discuss matters psychic, psychological, and literary. Brad invited Wolf and the Peruvian Good Samaritan inside for a cool drink and an escape from the blistering Arizona sun. After accepting a few minutes of hospitality, the salesman excused himself and said that he must be attending to business and appointments that he had made in Phoenix. Wolf thanked him for delivering him to the Steigers, then blessed the young man for his good heart and kindness. Wolf told Brad that he would not stay long. He had only come to give Brad a message. I think this is a message. "I will not live much longer," Wolf said. "From here, I will go to Berlin, where they will honor the memory of my mother, who was a poet laureate. I have only come to tell you that soon you will be alone to share the message of peace from space." Brad protested such talk of Wolf's death, and he insisted that Wolf stay with him for a few days before he resumed his pilgrimage. Wolf would accept only a bowl of soup, which Brad prepared for him, and he asked only if he might take the spoon with him for future meals on the road. After he had eaten the soup and placed the spoon in a small purse attached to the cloth belt that bound his robe, Wolf asked Brad to take him to a place outside the city where he would continue his journey by replying on the kindness of open-minded motorists, relying on the kindness of open-minded motorists, to pick up a hitchhiker dressed like a prophet from the Bible. As loudly and as strenuously as Brad protested against letting his friend off on the highway to fend for himself, Wolf calmly assured him that he would be protected. He had been traveling in such a manner for quite some time. Since Wolf would have it no other way, Brad did as his friend wished and brought him to a truck stop, where he prayed a righteous truck driver would take Wolf safely to a destination that only his inner guidance would determine. Dr. Wolfgang John Weilgart died in January 1981, and Brad has thought often of his friend and his remarkable life of mission and service. He was a child of five in his native Austria when Dr. Weilgart had his first cosmic experience in a forest. A stranger in a star-strewn mantle appeared to him and said, "Thou must die, Wolfgang." The young Wolfgang answered firmly and without hesitation, "I am ready." From that moment on, he felt that a new cosmic life stream had entered him, as if his former life had been dissolved, as if his former self had died. After his childhood visitation, Wolfgang dedicated to his older sister a drama, Seradurus, which in the language of space means that good light which comes through the spirit. Seradurus is a spaceman savior who comes to the earth to guide humankind away from its wars and to bring peace through understanding. The rules of peace revealed in this drama are not only derived from sentimental love, but also from a justice, which is based on status quo as well as on program of survival for those who are worthy to survive and can survive. Creative spirit lives on still. Destroyers perish while they kill. Dr. Weilgart related his most crucial cosmic experience in poetic form as an introduction to his book, A.U.I., the language of space, Pentecostal logos of love and peace. The boy Johnny, seated at a mountain creek, is altered to an alien presence by a strange flute-like sound. There is a mysterious being, a butterfly with green leafy wings and root-like legs, Johnny says. It circled and sat down on my knee. The sounds it made were piped through its flute-like body, and yet they wafted far away. From far away. And then I knew that this thing must have come from somewhere else, and I began to understand that it was talking to me. Could we be friends? It showed some strange signs and put them together, and they made sense. And what I heard was from another place. I learned the language of space. Johnny learns that the being has come from a distant star, from where his kind had watched Earthmen fight against the dragons and monsters of the ancient sagas. But now, when nature's foes lie defeated at his feet, man turns his weapons against his brethren, and his rallying cry is still the slogan of hate, the word of conventional language. Your words give murder a beautiful name and call a killer a hero. So if I gave you the gold of my wisdom wrapped in the burlap bags of your words, you would use it to club each other to death. When Wolfgang told his parents of his experience, they sent him to a psychiatrist who, however, found the six-year-old's only abnormality to be the fact that he could solve the problems of a 13-year-old. His Binet IQ tested above 200. In parentheses, Dr. Weilgart was made a member of American Mensa, the world's highest IQ society, end of parentheses. The psychiatrist warned the child that in Western society, uncommon experiences may be told only as dreams or in poems. Dr. Weilgart wrote his first doctoral dissertation on creation and contemplation. It was one of the few outspoken pacifist statements against Hitler and the whole Nazi ideology of aggressive action. His father, Dr. Hofrat Weilgartner, had worked for the Anschluss, I know how to say it, but I can't say it, A-N-S-C-H-L-U-S-S, the annexation of Austria by Germany. And so the Nazis expected similar cooperation from the sun. But Wolfgang John had another of his cosmic communications. He spent an afternoon and evening wrapped in contemplation, in a cosmic insight of peace, his father's dreams of glory of the German Reich, and his mother's entreaties faded into nothingness. The Nazis had offered Wolf a high position in their secret service because of his fluency in a dozen languages, his knowledge of psychology, and his friendship with the underground against whom they wished him to be an informer. Although this intelligence position would have been the only way to rehabilitate himself in the eyes of the Nazis, whom he had offended by his dissertation, Dr. Weilgart refused. His cosmic voice told him to flee to Holland. He had few friends whom he could trust and no connections with particular helpers. Following his inner voice, he set out for the border. He was stopped by a patrol, but the inner voice took over. And to his surprise, Dr. Weilgart heard himself command the patrol to another mission. Strangely, the patrol obeyed, as if Wolf had been in the uniform of a higher officer. I need to do this break and then come back and finish this one. Thank you.
Dog goes woof, cat goes meow, bird goes tweet, and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes crow, and the elephant goes toot. Ducks say quack, and fish go blub, and the seal goes ow, ow, ow. But there's one sound that no one knows. What does the fox say? Ding 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 ding. What does the fox say? Wap 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 wap. What does the fox say? Hatty 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 ho, hatty 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 ho, hatty 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 ho. What does the fox say? Chop 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 chop. What does the fox say? Big blue eyes, pointy nose, chasing mouse and digging holes. Tiny paws up the hill. Suddenly you're standing still. Your fur is red, so beautiful, like an angel in disguise. But if you meet a friendly horse, will you communicate by more, or more? How will you speak to that horse? What did the fox say? What did the fox say? What did the fox say? Ha 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 ho. Ha 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 ho. Ha 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 ha. What did the fox say?
Thank you. I had to run around and shut the house up. I got so hot, so I had to turn the AC on. Oh, boy. All right, we're talking about Wolf, and he just ordered a patrol guy as if he was in a uniform of a higher officer. Soon, Holland was being rapidly invaded by the Nazis, who would have executed Weilgarten as a deserter. The young mystic's inner voice brought him to the Dutch governor of Java, who happened to be in The Hague, and he wrote an American visa for Weilgarten and gave him a ship ticket. In the meantime, somebody had sent Weilgarten's poems to Thomas Mann, a Nobel Prize and Goethe Prize winner who gave him a postdoctoral research fellowship there to write his book, Shakespeare Psychognostic, maybe? Psychognostic. From 1945 to 1950, Weilgart served as professor at Xavier University for Tropians and Caucasians. Tropians for the race originating in tropic climates, and Caucasians are terms he preferred to blacks and whites, which make the contrast too harsh. Also, black in Western languages has a negative connotation. In AUI, the language of space, a Negro is called IAU, Sun Space Man. Sun Space Man, a man adapted to sunny regions. Then he received a United Nations research grant, finished his second doctoral degree in psychology and psychotherapy at the universities of Heidelberg and Zurich, became a psychotherapist for the UN, and invented the WERT, spelled W-E-R-T, Weilgart's Ethos Rhyme Test. That's what it stands for. Not only for crime and suicide prevention, but for personality development. Chand and Company of New Delhi, India, published Weilgart's Language of Space. The language of space makes man immune against the slavery of slogans and the idolatry of ideologies, for it makes language a communication of transparent truth. In 1971, Brad Steiger was contacted by Melanie, a housewife in Colorado, who suddenly began to recall a life on another world. At the same time, she began to go into trances to predict coming Earth changes. Brad was sent a tape on which Melanie uttered brief snatches of her native tongue during a trance session. Brad was told by other researchers that linguists at a number of universities in Canada and the United States had been unable to determine the root of this supposed language. Brad asked Dr. Weilgart if he would listen to the tape and see if he could offer any clues to the origins of this strange language. Dr. Weilgart found Melanie's dialect unknown to him in any language other than in the logos of AUI. Once before, when he was a young psychotherapist, Dr. Weilgart received a shock when he had encountered a young boy in a mental hospital who addressed him in AUI. Dr. Weilgart learned that the lad had been placed in the hospital because he insisted on speaking only in this language, which was unintelligible to his parents, teachers, and physicians. The young psychotherapist went to the director of the hospital and told him that the boy was not sick, that his language made sense. The director ignored Dr. Weilgart and ordered electroshock treatment for the boy. Oh, for crying out loud. Oh, just freaking irritates me. All right. The boy resisted the electroshock as much as he could. He told Dr. Weilgart that he feared the treatments would make him forget what he had learned on the other star. In his struggle, the boy died. Oh, my gosh. But with his dying words, he said to the psychotherapist, You believe in me. You tell others about the language of space. Now Dr. Weilgart was listening to a woman from Colorado who one day was a busy housewife and mother. The next, after touching the cosmos, a revelator who spoke often in an unidentified language. After touching the cosmos, how'd she touch the cosmos? Okay, so the psychotherapist in Wolf was cautious. He pointed out to Brad that the woman's unconscious might have retained bits and pieces of overheard Amerindian dialects, and now, years later, was resembling them and uttering them as a language from another world. But he wrote down a UI symbols as Melanie's voice uttered the sounds again and again from the tape recorder. Because Melanie spoke very rapidly, Dr. Weilgart was not able to hear all of her words, but he transcribed the following phrases which he plucked from the strange speech, way of movement around space, from life above space, to move for a light existence, a good existence in a dimension above space. Had Melanie somehow received a mental infusion of knowledge and awareness in the language of a multidimensional being on an otherworldly plane of existence? It's the end of that section. Here's a new one. His psyche traveled to the moon and beyond. Wouldn't that be fun? One day. Another great mystic who had unusual playmates from other dimensions as a child was our friend, the remarkable, sensitive Olaf Johnson. In the psychic feats of Olaf Johnson, Brad Steiger was able to relate Johnson's adult impressions of these entities. And I will read that to you in just a second here. Well, I knocked that over, didn't I? Hold on. There. I had to get some lip gloss. My lips are so dry. Okay. Unusual playmates. Oh, yeah, here it is. They may have been the same entities that so often represent themselves to small children as fairies and wood sprites. But somehow, on occasion, I believe that I was able to see them as they really were. They were taller than I, but not nearly as tall as my parents. They were perhaps just under or just over 5 feet tall. They had much larger heads and proportionally much smaller bodies than an adult. Their skin color varied from bluish green to golden brown to a shade of gray. It was they who began to tell me wonderful things about the universe and cosmic harmony. I felt that they were friends, that they wanted to teach me and to help me. I am still convinced that they are friendly and intend to help man as much as they can without interfering in humankind's own development and free will. Some may recognize the name Olaf Johnson as the psychic sensitive who was chosen by astronaut Edgar Mitchell for the Apollo 14 Moon-to-Earth ESP experiment in February 1971. Several months before launch-off, Mitchell had asked a select group of parapsychologists to locate a sensitive subject for an experiment across a million miles of space. Johnson, a Swedish-born Chicago drafting engineer and one of the most laboratory-tested psychics in the United States, was selected for this history-making experiment. As a witness to literally hundreds of tests and experiments with Olaf, from PK, psychokinesis mind over matter, to endless card-guessing tests with the Zender deck, star, circle, square, wavy lines, and cross, and as the author of his biography, Brad was hardly surprised when it was revealed that the psychic involved in the tests with Mitchell was Olaf Johnson. Once, when the two of them were discussing the possibility of intelligences on other planes of existence, Olaf said that he believed there to be forces in the universe, minds that can help us gain information about the true meaning of life. He believed that there is a dynamic force that the intelligences are associated with it. Who are these intelligences? Here we go. They could be entities from other places in the universe. Perhaps they are the souls of those who have died on highly evolved planets, who have left their radiation in the universe, and their intelligence remains as a force for good and for spiritual evolution. These intelligences may cloak themselves as holy figures, as wise old Tibetan monks, as astral teachers, but they are bodiless forms of benign intelligence. They may cloak themselves because the human brain will more readily accept an entity that looks like a human being rather than a shapeless, shimmering intelligence. These beings have the ability to absorb our actions and our thoughts so that they may know better how to direct us toward cosmic harmony. Yeah, I think I would be more inclined to believe the shimmering intelligence than I would human being. I have become so frickin' skeptical, untrusting. Let's see. These beings avoid language and work with us on an unconscious level. The phenomenon of telepathy affords us proof that language means nothing to the unconscious. We do not think in words, but in ideas and feelings. What language does God speak? The feelings and the heart. Harmony communicated between the unconscious levels of self constitute the one language that all humans understand. That is God's language. Olaf became one with the great mystery on May 11, 1998. Oh, that means he died. Oh, I see, on May 11, 1998. Ha! Pretty cool way to say it. Olaf became one with the great mystery on May 11, 1998. That's pretty cool. I like that. That's the end of that chapter. Now, let me take a peek here. Ooh, this is a big, big chapter. So is this next one. I mean, section. Well, this new chapter is Unknown Beings of Terror and the Dark Side. Wasn't there a show about that on TV, The Dark Side? I can't remember for sure. From time to time throughout history, unknown beings rise from the dark side of human consciousness to begin a campaign of terror that becomes contagious and spreads like a phantom virus across an entire nation. Like our frickin' Democrats, our swamp peoples. Let me read that, put in there. From time to time throughout history, unknown beings, like our swamp beings, arise from the dark side of human consciousness to begin a campaign of terror that becomes contagious and spreads like a phantom virus across an entire nation. Boy, that fits perfectly. Such seems to be the case with Slender Man, a contemporary boogeyman that rages unfettered throughout the United States. Our friend and colleague, the paranormal pastor Robin Swope, has been monitoring the mental monster gone amok since the beginning of this viral epidemic. This sounds like an interesting chapter. What time is it? I have like 6 minutes, 7 minutes. He was, Slenderman, Something Awful This Way Comes by Pastor Robin Swope. He was officially created in an internet contest when the readers of the Something Awful forums were asked to create a paranormal entity in a thread named Create Paranormal Images. The scheme was to create eerie images and use them to trick people on paranormal forums into thinking they were genuine. Users started photoshopping images by adding fake ghosts and other bizarre figures, usually accompanied by an imaginary backstory to make them seem authentic. On June 10, 2009, a user named Victor Surge posted to the thread with two photos and a claim that the entity stalked children. The explanation that Surge included with the photos was the haunting detail that the photographs were taken on a day on which 14 children disappeared. He then further explained that the library where the photo was found burned down a week after the pictures were taken. The entity was a shadow creature, overly tall and thin. It had long arms that stretched to inhuman lengths to ensnare its prey. To add to its unearthliness, the fiend had no face. His primary motivation was to kidnap and kill children. Supposedly, he was always seen just before the disappearance of a child, or even a mass kidnapping of multiple children. He seemed to prefer silently stalking in a fog and shrouded streets and wooded areas as he could obscure himself from the casual eye. However, children have been able to see him when adults in the vicinity could not. The mythos also stated that children have dreams or nightmares concerning a tall, slender man before their disappearance. The meme of Slender Man was born. Quickly, the mythos was explained. Once Slender Man was seen, he would stalk you for the rest of your life. His goal was to slowly drive you insane by appearing in your periphery, eventually threatening you with death. Soon his victims no longer were limited to children. Teenagers and adults were soon to become stalked by the tall, fearless man. The mythos quickly gained some trappings similar to ufology's Men in Black phenomena, as he appeared in a dark modern suit with white shirt and black tie. He also gained added appendages, which sprout from his sides like tree limbs. One UFO site adds, once his arms are outstretched, Slenderman's victims are put into something of a hypnotized state, where they are utterly helpless to stop themselves from walking into them. Slenderman is also able to create tendrils from his fingers and back that he uses to walk. Whether Slenderman absorbs, kills, or merely takes his victims to an undisclosed location or dimension is also unknown, as there are never any bodies or evidence left behind in his wake to deduce a definite conclusion. Soon, image boards across the web contain threads including original Slenderman art, as well as stories. Blogs were dedicated to the mythos, and YouTube videos chronicled the diabolical entity's torment of a few ill-fated individuals. In short order, there was an alternate reality game built around the monster, Marble Hornets, which combines YouTube and Twitter accounts to build a narrative surrounding a film student's discovery of horrifying film footage his friend had taken. Should I stop here, Nancy? Oh, well, I can read a couple more paragraphs. This one is a long section. I'm going to have to stop it eventually and start it next time. Okay, let me read. Let me read just the next paragraph. Some say the Slenderman myth is inspired by archaic archetypes of folklore like death stalking the plague-riddled inhabitants of medieval Europe, as depicted in Hans Holbein's 16th century woodcuts of the Dance of Death. But recently, the mythos and folklore have begun to manifest into real life. And then next week, we'll start from there.
Sounds reasonable.
Okay. I'll even mark it so that I know. Get my pencil. I got it marked. Okay. So, next coming up is Jamie, right?
We got Jamie coming up, yep. And we got you coming after that. And Jamie's talking about... What is she talking about? Evolving? Let me just look at this thing. What is Jamie talking... Yeah, when you're evolving. When you're evolving and the people around you aren't, I believe that's it.
Oh, boy, that happens, too.
Yeah.
Isn't this one the one that I did for Men Love Dolly?
Yes, it sounds a little menopausal to me.
I just want to try to help men.
Understand women? Whoa, yeah. You've got a real mission on your hands.
I think I did pretty good, but we'll see.
Okay.
Thanks for doing my half-hour breaks for me. It helps.
Not a problem. Love you. Be safe.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Why is this not going?